Thank you very much, Sam, and thank you very much for having me, Sam, and everybody. And thank you for mentioning the upcoming book. I guess this is about the closest to the movie of the book that there will be. So enjoy it while you've got it, we'll see how that goes. I do want to begin, however, by taking you to the theatre. In his essay-length review of Stephen Pimlott's 1993 production of T.S. Eliot's play, Murder in the Cathedral, there's T.S. Eliot, critic Emrys Jones argued that the play succeeded in performance as a drama, though helped significantly by some adventurous and skillful direction, despite the fact that the religious appeal of the play was now no longer relevant. Was now no longer relevant to most of the audience. Let's see what that's doing. There we go. Despite the fact the religious appeal of the play was no longer relevant to most of the audience, this critic had argued that, in fact, the play had succeeded its performance. And now Eliot's play, if you haven't read it or seen it, tells the story of the medieval archbishop and martyr, Thomas Becket, not a photograph of him, that's a photograph of the production, who was slaughtered in Canterbury Cathedral by a group of knights claiming to act at the behest of King Henry II. Henry had expressed annoyance at Thomas's stubborn refusal to make the church serve his political ends. Another reviewer, the great English critic Sir Frank Commode, went so far as to claim that in his judgment, it was true that, generally speaking, the emphasis has shifted from martyrdom to an agonized secular heroism. The director, it seemed, had reckoned with a much more secular audience than perhaps Eliot had imagined when he first put on the play in the 1930s. As Jones writes, loosened from its ecclesiastical origins, the play has inescapably become more of a purely literary classic. And as it has moved further into the past, its 1930s Christian religiosity has also become more of an historical phenomenon. I think he was perhaps overestimating 1930s Christian religiosity, but here he's saying, look, this religiosity is very much in the past, a thing of the past, out of date. Now, he's not arguing for such a change. Rather, he counts himself as merely observing it, as the director seems to have done. The power of the drama is less likely to reside in the identification of the audience with Thomas as Christians trying to live the Christian life. They're less likely to see him as one of them in terms of Christianity. And so they've got to find a connection by some other means if they're going to like and enjoy the play and relate to it and learn from it. Pimlott, the director, deliberately cast Thomas as a non-spiritual man, a skillful manager and a politician, perhaps, but certainly not, obviously, a holy man. Another critic, Craig Raine, questioned whether the play itself can now really work as a play, even if a skillful production of it can. If the key component at the core of Thomas's motivation is no longer credible, then are we not forced to supply different meaning to the death before us than the one given? It is surely the case that if the religion of Eliot and of Thomas is now redundant, 1930s religiosity, we must side with one of the alternative interpretations of his murder that the play makes available. Removing the religious component of the death of the Archbishop leaves you with, well, what kind of death exactly? In what way is the death at all honourable or noble or admirable or representative if it is just a secular death of some kind? In fact, Eliot makes sure that we cannot make this move if you read the script closely. There is no cause for which Thomas dies. He is no Martin Luther King or Gandhi, no secularized saint. There is no particular noble cause of which he is the symbol. In fact, Thomas resists at every turn secularizing himself. That's surely the point. Eliot resists making him a modern hero representative of some modern cause. If the religious component of the play is excised, as these critics think it should be, is not Thomas guilty of neglect of his duty, his people and his country? Is he not convicted then of seditious action, of willfully provoking the wrath of the king in order to secure his place in history? What comfort or lesson can modern audiences take from this? Thomas is just the kind, if this is the case, Thomas is just the kind of fanatic we would like to avoid. Now, Commode's suggestion of an agonized secular heroism, it's an intriguing phrase, is an agonized secular heroism, is clearly untenable, however, in this case. There's nothing heroic about Thomas in the ordinary or in any sense. In fact, Eliot describes heroism as one of the temptations he must overcome, avoid, if he's to be truly a Christian martyr. Jones, for his part, I think makes a stronger case. He reminds us that the play is not a play, is a play, sorry, and not a theological or devotional discourse. In his opinion, too many critics have read the play precisely the other way round. It's not intended as a flat text, but as a script to be enlivened by a performance. And so he asserts that Murder in the Cathedral has a real dramatic action at its centre, and that it expresses a powerful aesthetic coherence of its own that is independent of the religious ideas that stimulated its creator. He says it works as a play without all that religious guff, basically. It works. He's a feasible hero without Christianity. Just as the Greek plays continue to be powerful, humanly convincing, and aesthetically pleasing to contemporary audiences, even though virtually no one holds to the mythic and religious ideas found in them, and if you do, I'd love to hear from you, so Eliot's drama will become part of the canon of great writing for the stage in the English language. Eliot has written a play that works, says Jones, in terms of its action alone. These critical responses are illustrative of the contemporary inability to come to terms with the Christian martyr as anything but a pitiable and/or possibly dangerous figure. These critical responses are illustrative of a contemporary inability to come to terms with the Christian martyr as either anything but a pitiable or a dangerous person. If the convictions that move Thomas, or any other Christian martyr for that matter, do not convict the modern audience at some level, then it's hard to know how the drama can have any purchase other than as a kind of historical curio. However, Jones thinks the historical reference and the authenticity of the events depicted is perhaps more significant than it at first seems, because these events are not invented as a morality tale of rather sentimental proportions, and because these are representations of real people engaged in what was a well-testified event, locatable in space and datable in time, then the audience is not afforded the luxury of dismissing them as somehow fantastical and inhuman. The play, he says, takes its strength from its fidelity to history. As we watch, we remember that this is an imitation of something that actually happens. Now, I presume he means by this that there is something universal about this, or rather something identifiably human in the calamity that plays out before us. But I would wish to argue that the play is powerful as a drama, certainly at that immediate and surface level of the audience's first encounter with it, but that this unusual and striking power is dependent on the Christian component of the play, in a way in which the Greek tragedy is not in the same way dependent upon its religious worldview. This is because the Christian gospel is itself the form of a dramatic action. The play draws its power from, I should say, the Christian gospel, which is itself a dramatic action. Christianity is not at all disconnected from the action of the play, as if it inhabits only the fringes of the script in perplexing religious forms and can be cut out like a boring movement from a symphony. Rather, it everywhere and necessarily gives its actual form to the action of the play. What I mean by that is this. The death of Thomas is unmistakably an imitation of the death of Jesus Christ. The form of the action of the play resembles in its outline the temptation, passion, and death of Jesus, without which it cannot bear its full meaning. That's a picture of the spot where he was killed, Thomas, that is. We could go further in taking up Jones' point about the historical aspect of the play too. The connection with historical events through imaginative and symbolic reconstruction is quite distinctly a Christian development. Granted, Greek drama and literature on occasion took its subjects from history or from prehistory, but it turned them into types and showed no real interest in the correspondence of the action to the history, to the action in history. It wasn't interested in whether these events really happened so much. In the Christian imagination, on the other hand, historical events are traceable in direct line back from the present. And though clearly fictional elements are added to the reconstruction of the event in order to make the dramatization appealing within the convention of literary forms, the theatre in this case, we see reminders to the audience everywhere that there are real historical events to which the action is intended to correspond, and of which the audience is meant to have a vicarious experience. You're meant to enter into the world of this historic, you're meant to kind of be reminded of the real world even as you're sitting in the theatre. Could it ever be said of a Greek drama, as Jones says of Murder in the Cathedral, that it takes its strength from its fidelity to history? Could you say that about Antigone or any of the other Greek plays? As we have seen, and as Eliot demonstrates in his play, a Christian view of the world and of the self within that world rests on an understanding of providence, not fortuna, as in the Greek plays. And so history necessarily takes on a different significance as a meaningfully continuous series of events. That the God of Jesus Christ, and not Dame Fortune or her little sister Lady Luck, is providentially at work in human history accounts for an enormous difference to the souls that have to live in that history. The contention that the play could work as a drama within the Christian, when the Christian aspect of it has been chopped out and lost its appeal, then is, I think, quite ill-founded. The dramatic impact of the play, whatever connection it might make with its audience, comes, if it does, precisely on account of its construction as a narrative within a Christian framework, which gives it a coherence and a poignancy evidently beyond the grasp of these reviewers. To be drawn into the world of the play then is to accept, at least for a time, Eliot's construal of the way time and space are ordered and arranged, providentially. The alternative, it seems, is that the audience must become hostile to Thomas and to his playwright, and so side with his murderers in accusing and convicting him. It is facile to suggest, as these reviewers have, that the contemporary audience's lack of interest and even mistrust of institutional Christianity can be set aside by the tricks of the director and by good acting, or to draw the false dichotomy, as he does, between drama and religious text. Rather, the narrative logic of the play and its theological meaning are inseparable. Now, I hope you're sitting there going, why the heck does any of this matter? Right? I'm only 8 pages in. Why does it matter? It matters because we live in a world full of martyrs and would-be martyrs. This discussion of responses to the drama captures in a nutshell the bewilderment and even distaste that many secular people experience when trying to consider what kind of life the Christian person lives. A life that potentially is given away in martyrdom. A life that, for one great Roman Catholic theologian of the 20th century, Hans Urs von Balthasar, is the for him, martyrdom is the external representation of the inner reality of the Christian life. Every Christian is potentially a martyr. That seems, following this little discussion, to be an offensive and untenable way of being a self, not really graspable by these secular reviewers. It is true that sometimes an attempt is made to secularize the Christian martyrs, as was done in this play, by focusing possibly on the manner of their deaths or on some exercise of impressive virtue that they showed under trial, how noble they were, or perhaps on the injustice against which they stood, to recast them as heroes of acceptable values under a secular paradigm, in other words. But, as in the case of British novelist Salman Rushdie, who calls religion a poison in the blood, he doesn't usually leave anyone in any doubt what he thinks, martyrdom is frequently cast as the result of a dangerous overdose of ego. It is a failure to live, and a corruption of love. It amounts to a denial of the duty to live with others, a denial which is particularly unacceptable in the contemporary world of shifting global allegiances and identities. This amounts to an inauthentic and dubious form of selfhood, it would seem. You can't be a person like that. The spectre of religious violence hangs always and already over any discussion of martyrdom in the modern setting. Martyrs are more likely to inspire fear and loathing than reverence. I once took the story of the early Christian martyr Polycarp into the classroom when I was a school chaplain. And in a way, this is what prompted my study here, a study on martyrdom. I took his story into the classroom. He was 86 or so, or even older when he died, and when he was burnt. And the story is there. He's given lots of opportunity to repent of his Christianity by the local authorities, and he refuses. The students in the classroom, their reaction was to think he was a silly old duffer. What an idiot, they thought. What an alarming person. They were bewildered why he didn't just sacrifice to the emperor and be done with. And I realized here are two different versions of being a self, two different ways of construing the human human identity. And so it might be suggested at this point that there are really two incommensurate and rival anthropologies or rationalities in play, with no conceivable way of mediating between them. These different reactions to Christian martyrdom indicate that there is a dissonance between these two different rationalities or worldviews. And so it's worth asking at this point whether martyrdom becomes the ultimate no to further communication with the other point of view. The willingness to be killed, as much as it is chosen by the martyr, almost as much as the willingness to kill, is the placing of an insurmountable barrier of blood between the two parties, the Christian and the secular. Is Christian martyrdom then merely a point at which two worldviews are shown to be irreconcilable, and no more can be said, the scene of a great collision of identities? Is it merely a gesture of defiance against the alternate order of power? It would certainly seem to be the case if we look at suicide bombing, which usually comes under the heading of martyrdom in the sort of secular press in the way it's spoken about. That seems to be a gesture which says, basically, I hate you all, and I don't want to communicate with you. I only want to defy and scare you. I only want to communicate my defiance of you. Is Christian martyrdom like that? Well, I would wish to say that claim that Christian martyrdom is a remarkably successful form of communication with the world, if not universally so. It succeeds as witness. By the 4th century, the martyrs had succeeded not only in overcoming, but by convincing many of their enemies. The note that Christian martyrdom strikes is dissonant to the extent that it exposes the futility of opposition to God. Martyrdom testifies to the non-ultimacy of human political power, and it testifies in address to that power itself. Sometimes, it seems, even the rulers and the executioners, or if not they, then the people seeing it, get the message. For the church, as Tertullian's axiom runs, the blood of the martyrs is the seed. Which is to say, the martyr's blood convinces outsiders of the need to become insiders. Christian martyrdom is not barbaric or rebarbative or merely destructive. It could never involve flying planes into buildings. Nor is it merely a death wish, an act of suicide. But rather, when it is authentically expressed, follows the example of the Lord who enjoined his followers to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. The self understood in Christian martyrdom is loyal even when resistant, but at the same time manages to relativize and critique human pretensions to power. It is apposite to recall the role of bloody martyrdoms too, including that of Archbishop Janani Luwum in 1977, in resistance to Idi Amin, the terrible dictator of Uganda, and in resistance to atheistic totalitarianism behind the Iron Curtain, and in the survival and growth of the churches in contemporary China, all within the last two centuries. If Christian martyrdom is to be true to its fundamental nature as a witness to the death of Jesus Christ, it cannot, in the last resort, be seen as a defiant gesture, but as one which is an invitation to join with the martyr in worship of the one Lord of heaven and earth. As such, there is in Christian martyrdom the invitation of contact, the possibility that the observer of the martyr's death or the hearer of her story being drawn into the world that the martyr describes, the world that the martyr lives in. I guess I'm arguing that there's a cognitive dissonance, sure, a shock that comes in what the martyr does, but this shock is intelligible, and this shock actually makes shocking sense. The question then must be, what is it about this form of selfhood that communicates? What is it about this way of life that communicates, if it does? The question asks at a deeper level, what is it in martyrdom, coming as it does precisely out of the Christian understanding of the self and the world, that external representation of the inner life of every Christian, what about that is able to be meaningful enough in the terms of a worldview that is at least at face value, utterly hostile to it? How is it that some people seem to get it? The New Testament calls its own message, the word of the cross, in which martyrs live out, a scandalon, and so indeed are its reenactments. Theologically speaking, it is only the Spirit of God himself who illuminates this enactment of the gospel of Jesus as a testimony to the truth. It's a spiritual thing. Of course, an act of God that anyone would understand this as being the truth. Martyrologists who exaggerate the details of the suffering and torture of the martyrs in order to increase the rhetorical impact of their work are in fact doing the martyr a great disservice. They are acting as if a divine act was in need of a little human enhancement to be effective, dressing it up a little bit, emphasizing the gore. The risk here is that the martyr is painted merely as a victim, right? And the rhetorical impact of telling the story is then limited to the pathos that we experience, the suffering. Oh dear martyr, how terrible they suffered in this way. The content of their witness then disintegrates. The Gospels show the way here. As we read of the death of Jesus, I'm not sure if you've ever been struck by this, if you've read the Gospels, if that's something you do. We may feel pity for the disciples, for sure, and sorrow for the role that our fellow human beings played in his execution, and even disgust and outrage at the injustice perpetuated. But the evangelists don't draw us to pity Jesus, do they? They don't dwell on the gruesome details of his torture and suffering. Sorry to say, Mel Gibson. Right? They do not portray him as powerless or voiceless. They do not depict the sadistic pleasure of his executioners. Jesus is no victim. Events do not get out of hand for him at all. He is seen as always ahead of them. His innocence is not established merely so he can feel appalled at this terrible miscarriage of justice, but so that we can understand the significance of his sacrifice in a theological matrix. There were and are worse and more painful deaths. There certainly were and are more pitiable victims of injustice than Jesus. Jesus is not like some protagonist in Greek tragedy, the victim of a twist in fate or the misalignment of the planets. An account that emphasizes the pathos of Jesus' death, asking us to sympathize with him, feel sorry for him, quite misses the point, which is this, that the cross of Jesus Christ is the expression par excellence of the divine rule over all. It's that moment, which is the moment of the enthronement of Israel's Messiah in Zion and over the whole world. Likewise, a martyrology that dwells too luridly on the blood that flows is not a martyrology, but a victimology, and calculated only to produce resentment. And I think this is perhaps part of the reaction that we have to the use of martyrdom in the contemporary world, is that too often it's dwelt on the suffering and the victimizing of the particular person, and has been used then to breed resentment, that my group has always been picked on by your group, and so I can therefore go and pick on a few of your group. A death cast in these terms, in the end, witnesses only to itself as a death. The best of the early martyr acts, which are not perfect documents for all their faults, do not lapse in this direction. The Bishop Polycarp, for example, though of great age, dies in such a way that his captors look sillier than he. Events are not in their control, nor in Polycarp's either. But Polycarp's faith and his assurance make it a triumph. Who could feel sorry for him? For contemporary theologian David Bentley Hart, the gift of martyrdom is the absolute peak of the Christian practice of persuasion, encapsulating its form and referencing its content. His stated project in his work is to mount a defense of the beauty to whose persuasive power the Christian rhetoric of evangelism appeals, against the charge from contemporary philosophy that this Christian rhetoric of peace is inescapably violent. And that's kind of part of what's behind this kind of reaction to martyrdom in the modern world. The sense that when we speak about martyrdom, we're always kind of perpetuating religious violence, which so blots our planet. But David Bentley Hart thinks differently, and he writes this. He says, Christ is a persuasion, and the whole force of the gospel depends upon the assumption that this persuasion is also peace. That the desire awakened by the shape of Christ in his church is one truly reborn as agape, as love, rather than merely the way in which a lesser force succumbs to a greater, as an episode in the endless epic of power. What Christ does is not an act of domination over, it's an act of dying for. Likewise, the martyrs, the true Christian martyrs, are dying for, not dying in order to establish power over, he says. Look, if the Christian gospel is merely an iron fist, even if it's placed sometimes in a velvet glove, then the postmodern charge is here sustained. Hart closes his book with a chapter entitled The Gift of Martyrs. Hart's a great way to finish a book, in which he shows well that the Christian practice of authority contrasts markedly in form from the exercise of governmentality. And if you've read your Foucault, you'll know what that's all about, the kind of exercise of power by spreading power around, the way you use language and deploy and manipulate people. It's different in nature. Christian martyrdom shows us that it's completely different in nature. And Hart continues by saying, theology and the church must, because of what its particular story is, have the form of martyrdom, witness, a peaceful offer that has already suffered rejection and must be prepared for rejection as a consequence. Through its imitation of Christ's manner of rule, of Christ's way, which the martyrs exemplify, the Christian community shows itself to be ruled by just such a servant Lord. What Hart rightly shows is that in the very clinging of the disciples to Jesus Christ, to that mode of speech and life, which is the only one consonant with the message of the gospel that Christians are commissioned to preach, the ubiquitous temptations of power are to be evaded. So even though we speak of an inner conviction that comes from God, it's also possible to speak on the human side of the question. I said before, in one sense, martyrdom will only, just as Christ will only convince in a spiritual way. It's only because of an act of God, a divine act, that people become convinced of this message, that this is a witness, a true witness. But it is possible to speak of the human way in which this is convincing as an offer. The witness as a way of being a self. The witness of the martyr occurs within the human sphere of speaking and listening, acting and observing. Martyrdom is an imitation of the cross of Christ. As an imitation of the cross of Christ, is an embodiment by the church of the gospel that it preaches. As such, nothing is more alienating. By acting in this way, the church throws into question every man's everyday assumptions about the meaning of life and the human good. The Christian martyr walks away from these meanings, walks away from these goods, not because they are blatantly wrong or not goods, but because they aren't enough. But martyrdom is not only given a critical function, it's also a dramatic performance of the death of Christ for the world. As a lived drama, as a narrative performed, as an enactment of Jesus' own death, Christian martyrdom invites the outsider to consider the truth to which the martyr testifies. In Christian martyrdom, speech and action are spectacularly united. It is truth-telling with everything that someone can muster. The way in which martyrs actually reveal to the world the way the world really is, for the sake of the world, on the one hand, and the transforming power of the Spirit at work through the holiness of the saints, on the other. That is how martyrdom communicates. That is how it is a witness to and for the world and not just a clash of the two irreconcilable ways of being a self. This here is a narrative action, a meaningful performance that someone does in their life, which makes a claim about what is true. It claims for itself a referent in the real world of flesh and blood, life and death. Or, as William Kavanagh puts it, I like this, what he said here, the pyres which burn the martyrs' bodies serve as a light for the world, not isolating the community of believers, but calling all to the city on the hill. Saint Ignatius of Antioch, back in the first century, addressing the Christians of Rome, where he himself soon was to be martyred, wrote this: "Have mercy on me, brethren. Do not hold me back from living. Do not wish that I die. Let me arrive at the pure light. Once there, I will be truly a man. Let me imitate the passion of my God." Christian martyrdom is not a making of one's own meaning as a human being. It's not a tracing out of one's own authenticity or identity. The Christian disciple is satisfied merely to declare, "I'm a Christian," and to leave the rest in the hands of Providence, known as it is in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. In martyrdom, there's an attempt by one human being to eviscerate the humanity of the other, of another. Yet the promise is that it is the inhumanity of the perpetrator which is actually unmasked. Further, we see anticipated in martyrdom, in the true humanity of the martyr, to use Ignatius' notion. You see, he says, "I will be there truly a man, finally." The divine vindication of the martyr, in that it echoes the decisive death of Jesus Christ, who was raised from the dead. Thank you very much. Yeah? So your question is, you're saying in your question that if martyrdom is a death that is a dying for them,
not over them,
but then what's the second half?
It suffers rejection.
Yeah.
And then it has to go and suffer rejection again.
What do you mean by again?
Well,
in terms of dying for the world, the Christian martyr, you see, doesn't seek to impose him or herself, but rather suffers in an imitation of Christ so that people can see what Christ's death was. And that's the remarkable thing about the early martyr acts, is how often they keep pointing to, how it was recorded, they keep pointing to Christ and saying, you know, they're asked, "Who are you?" And continually they say, "Nobody but Christ." And, you know, the title of my thesis, which the publisher didn't like, was "I Wish to Be None Other Than I Am." And that was the word said by Secunda, who was a martyr in North Africa. And she's asked, you know, "Come on, can you sacrifice to the emperor?" And she can't deny who she is. She is Christ. That's nothing. There's nothing more that she is. And so what she does in dying is a kind of dramatic imitation of Christ. It's evangelization, isn't it? It's an invitation to see, a reminder of what Christ does. Not a substitute for what Christ does, but a witness. That's, of course, the meaning of the word martyr, a witness, a testimony to Christ, and particularly in acting in his form. Did that clarify, perhaps?
Yeah, that's good. So if somebody is flying planes to the moon,
yes, bad. It's different in a number of ways. It's different because the Christian martyr never pursues martyrdom as an end in itself. The Christian person, this is clarified in the early church, and particularly Augustine eventually particularly pronounced very strongly on this, the Christian martyr doesn't seek martyrdom for its own sake. The Christian only seeks to witness to Christ. Providence, that the hand of God might be, that means that there is a persecution and that there are, in fact, that there is bloodshed for Christ in that sense. But the Christian martyr never seeks martyrdom as an end itself. Suicide has never been on the Christian mind. And Augustine, and people were, there was a bit of a romance about martyrdom in the early church, and people, because people if you die testifying to Christ, well, then people thought, well, you must be guaranteed of a place in heaven. So people were kind of keen to get out there and die. Why not? In fact, you know, you hear stories of people running around to the governor and going, "Hi, I'm a Christian. Would you please do me in?" This really happened. So Augustine's quite keen to say, no. This is never the Christian option here. Martyrdom is an act of God. It's what God, you know, under the providential hand. So you see in the suicide bomber, you see a seizing of providence, actually. You kind of see a taking of providence in your own hands, a wish to control and assert and terrify, not, you know, you see a big difference, I think. Would anyone like to add or come back to that? Yeah. It fits exactly in, because I think every Christian is potentially a martyr. One mistake that's been made in Christian history has been to see the martyrs as sort of superheroes, when in fact the way Jesus speaks about Christian discipleship is that every Christian dies to self. And once again, it's not you don't set out to intend to be a martyr. You set out to intend to follow Christ. Martyrdom may follow, is the structure of things here. And so that's what I meant when I referenced Hans Urs von Balthasar, a Catholic scholar writing in the 60s. And he said the external Christian martyrdom is the external representation of the inner reality of the Christian. They used to talk about red martyrdom and white martyrdom. White martyrdom was what every Christian did in dying to self and now rising, but, you know, being given second birth. Red martyrdom was, you know, that was when blood got shed, which happens. Yeah. Sam.
What you're saying there, the authentic Christian identity, the Christian self, yes, is to have this idea of yourself as a martyr.
Well, yes, I suppose so. Martyr as a word, of course, means witness. It's and that's the primary meaning that I want to get through. That is, your life is a sign, a pointer, a testimony to Christ and Christ's death and resurrection. The whole of your life, and it might be that this is taken, you know, you have a chance to do that in extremis, but that's not something, that's not a sought path, you know, that final point is not a sought path. Your witness may end in, it might consist of all sorts of things in your particular life, your imitation of Christ. Did you want to come back?
Yeah, and so with that in mind, what do you think are some of the challenges which modern maintain that identity?
Well, I thank you for that question. That's what do modern Christians have to do to maintain that identity? I think a couple of things. First of all, we need to remember the worldwide church and the way in which it's being persecuted. Often, the way in which religious violence is reported is as religious violence. That's not to say, that is, it's reported as, oh, well, religious people are beating each other up again. And we miss the fact that actually many, many Christians are being persecuted in different parts of the world and experiencing martyrdom even as we speak. This is not a new phenomenon. You know, this is not sort of only an ancient phenomenon. And I think the Western, the sleek, fat Western church of which we're a part, needs to remember that our body is being persecuted in other parts of the world. But secondly, I think we need to realise that Christian discipleship is lived under the guiding hand of providence, but under conditions too, which result in spiritual attacks. I would call them tests. They can be temptations. They can be tests in the sense of external, you know, persecutions. For the Western Church, it tends to be that our spiritual test. Is more a sort of temptation of the body, I suppose, a temptation to be distracted. And those things, in a way, have the same nature, I think. They're contradictions to the Word of God in our experience. It can be a ruler, it can be the dear leader in North Korea telling taking the Christians off to labor camps, as he does in their thousands. It can be the allure of our Western way of life. These, in one sense, have them they have the same nature in that they form tests, contradictions to the way Christians view the world, a way we've learnt that from the Christian gospel. That kind of, yeah, yes. Yeah, the Western world rather than the Western church, yeah. Well, I think martyrdom, Christian martyrdom both succeeds and fails as a testimony to Christ. And that's of its true nature. That is, some people just see it's absurd and silly, daft, offensive. We expect those reactions are expected. But I think once we hear the stories and reminded of the stories of people who have given their lives in such circumstances, under, you know, with a deep trust in Christ, in the hand of providence, acting, you know, serving and imitating the resurrected Lord. Then I think it's actually can be quite persuasive. It's a persuasive gospel, both spiritually. There's a spiritual element to it, but there's a humanly persuasive element to it as well. So, yeah, the apostles always, they try and convince people, but they know that there's a spiritual element to that convincing as well, and they don't always succeed 100%. I think that's of the nature of the beast. Yeah. By who? I haven't spoken to people in China. I certainly have spoken to Ugandan Christians who have had two great episodes in their church history, in their church life, where martyrdom has just been a big feature of what's gone on. Under Idi Amin in the 1970s, there's a student at college from Uganda at the moment who's studying the life that kind of period. And martyrdom particularly of the Archbishop, did all sorts of remarkable things. It certainly undermined the power, not immediately, but it served to undermine the power of that terrible dictator. It united, actually brought Christians together across tribal boundaries in a way in which there had been a lot of infighting prior to that. But he would claim that that the celebration and the remembrance of the martyrdom of particularly this Archbishop had a remarkable galvanizing effect in terms of the life of the church there. Do you know any? Would you add any stories to that? Yeah. But I'd certainly say that. Yeah, that's a great question. Does it still have to be? Is it still martyrdom if the violence is inescapable? So you think about. Can you think of an example? I mean, I think the Staineses in India, there was a story in the last decade of a Baptist couple from Australia who were, actually it was a father and son, wasn't it, who was burnt to death by an angry Hindu mob in India. And I think there was no sense in which he kind of got told, by the way, you know, are you a Christian or aren't you? Because we're going to burn you if you're not. He didn't get that option. I guess technically speaking, if it's to be a real imitation of Christ, it has to have that Gethsemane moment, doesn't it? It has to have that moment where not my will but yours. However, that doesn't mean that the kind of the life and death of a person like Graham Staines can't sort of have of the nature of a martyrdom. I think technically speaking, no, it doesn't. It doesn't kind of fit the pattern, but you know, his choices all along the line to serve God in these circumstances kind of contributed to where he was at the time. And certainly his life, his death was martyr-ish. So, martyrly. So it was a witness of a kind. Because I'm not, I think the Roman Catholic Church has particularly got this category, this clear category of here's a martyr and here isn't. I don't think we need to buy into that so much. We can remember the remarkable testimony of Christians past, and we can speak about that and see that witness and feel ourselves surrounded by the cloud of witnesses without kind of having to sort of go through a lengthy process and bring out a huge church committee, and as they do, you know, the canon lawyers. What a calling that must be. Yes. Just anyone else?
I've got two questions.
Yeah.
One, what about persecution within the church?
Yes.
And two, what about people who are martyred to the point of me again and survive?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first question, well, let's answer the second question first, because I think it's a bit easier. What about people who are sort of persecuted to the point of death but then survive? I think like Graham Staines and like this example I said here, that there is a testimony. You know, there's a kind of, technically they are not martyrs in the sense that traditionally we've used the sense of martyrs, but their lives are often a testimony to Christ in what they've done. The imitation of Christ is not exact. It happens in different circumstances. That's how it can happen in my life. And in your life, we can imitate Christ in different ways. So I'm happy to say, again, use a kind of broad category of martyrliness or something. Invent your own term. The first question, what was that again? So between Christians? Yeah, now that's a very complex... There's a very sort of ancient history of this too. What happens when Christians persecute other Christians? Of course, the Reformation era... was a period where, you know, Catholic and Protestant martyred one another, and the Anabaptists too. If there's any Anabaptists here, they're always quick to say, oh, you both picked on us. any Anabaptists here? So I have some good Anabaptist friends who never stop reminding me of this. I think, broadly speaking, there's sort of three eras of martyrdom. This is my own, out of my own head. The first one is the early church, where you've got the challenge of the Roman Empire. The second era... skipping over about 1,000 years, and I'm sure there's more to say about that 1,000 years, but moving forward to the Reformation, it was really a clarification within the church, wasn't it? It was a kind of sense in which there was an intra-church struggle, a struggle between ideas of falsehood and truth. And I'd have to say there's disgrace on both sides, isn't there? I think... then the last era, I think, I consider it to be the kind of era of missionary martyrdom, where missionaries go out and they're not confronting the Roman Empire. They're not kind of being confronted by a church force, but they're actually meeting, going out into the world. What about that Roman? What about that that Reformation period? I don't know what to say really, other than bad, wasn't it? I think it's still the case that, first of all, Christians should not be the persecutors. And I think there's a lot forgotten in that. Between mixing the church and the state was extremely problematic, wasn't it? Using state power to enact church discipline was the real problem there, wasn't it? And I think even if it was on the right side, I don't, you know, I think it's something to be deeply, you know, regretted, even if it was on the side of truth. Augustine used to say, he was very much against persecuting Christians, but when it came to heretics, well, he said, bring it on. They're heretics, go burn them. You know, people, you know, serious stuff here. I think Augustine was wrong at that point. And I think actually it's through that period that Christians have come, I think, and learnt to stand for religious freedom. And so the religious freedom we enjoy is actually a product of the Christian experience. To a large measure. And particularly the Protestant experience, I would say. Yeah. Did anyone want to add anything to that? I think that's a complex little question to finish on. Thank you.